There's hardly any tide here, and there are no salt water marks on his clothing.
Montana drew a deep breath. You come here this morning for a swim. Find an appallingly mutilated body, recognize the young man by his tattoo, hold his hand, and then examine the corpse for clues.
Poldi said nothing.
Montana took another look at his notes. Valentino had been missing for 3 days.
Four, counting today, since Monday.
Montana wrote, Monday, and ringed the word.
And you were worried?
Yes.
Why?
Because you worry when someone who is normally reliable suddenly disappears and doesn't answer his phone.
Had something happened between the two of you?
Mutable eyes or no, Poldi was getting sick of being questioned.
Certainly not, she snapped. I'm just a caring person. It comes naturally to me.
To search a murder victim?
Madonna, commissario, what the hell are you getting at?
The chief inspector gave Poldi a long, long look that pierced her to the marrow. Then he handed back her car key.
Thank you, Signora Oberreiter. That will be all for the moment. I have your address in Torre.
Their fingers briefly touched as the key changed hands. Poldi gave a start.
Number 29, Via Baronessa, she purred. It's easy enough to find.
I hope you aren't planning to leave the island in the immediate future.
He looked at her again, his bright eyes sad despite the laughter lines. Poldi smiled at him and started the car.
That would be extraordinarily stupid of me, Commissaria. You chatted him up,
I exclaimed when she told me about it later.
You find a dead body and flirt with the chief investigator. You're simply... shameless?
No. Totally cool.
Poldi smiled, looking flattered.
I had to lay a little scent, Mark. And nothing is more appealing to a detective than a mixture of half-truths and subtle eroticism.
What made you so sure Montana would soon be ringing your doorbell?
Why, I pegged him as a real pro right away. One day at most, I told myself, and he'll discover that I went looking for Valentino. And what does that mean?
I didn't have a clue.
He'll know that I was one of the last people to see Valentino alive,
she explained,
and that I may know more than he does.
That figured.
Within a few hours, Torre Akirafi was enveloped in a fog of rumours, a toxic aerosol of conjectures, remarks hastily cut short, half-truths, whispered names, meaningful glances and eloquent smiles. My aunt's name did not, however, crop up amid these nebulous rumours, a circumstance Poldi attributed to the handsome commissario, who had clearly enjoined the whole police force to silence. She did not delude herself that something wouldn't leak out sooner or later, but until it did she might be able to glean some information while feigning dismayed ignorance. Although no clear picture emerged from the rumours, everyone in town seemed to associate Valentino's death in some way with his activities for Russo.
Simply blown away,
Signor Busaca whispered to Poldi next morning, when she went to replenish her supply of cigarettes and buy a copy of La Sicilia, which had splashed the murder on its front page.
The whole head. A ghastly mess. Blood everywhere, lashings of it.
Gossip was the last thing Poldi felt like that morning. She was feeling thin-skinned and irritable, but her curiosity was stronger than the impulse to get back into bed and ignore the world.
"You mean you saw it?"
she asked with simulated horror.
"Not personally,"
Signor Busaca was forced to concede,
"but I've got a close acquaintance in the Carabinieri."
"It's awful. Simply awful."
Poldi mopped her perspiring brow.
"He was such a nice young man. Who would do such a thing?"
Signor Busaca glanced around and leant towards her.
My close acquaintance in the Carabinieri isn't supposed to talk about it, but...
He cleared his throat and hesitated, as if to satisfy himself of my aunt's discretion.
Not a word, Poldi whispered back. Officially, of course, all lines of inquiry are being explored. The fact is, however, my friend in the task force hinted at the existence of some definite leads.
Busaka straightened up as if he'd already said too much.
What sort of leads?
He raised his hands.
Well, the murder weapon, Donna Poldina. A lupara. That says it all, surely.
You mean Valentino was murdered by the Cosa Nostra?
Busaka gave an almost imperceptible start, as though bitten by a mosquito.
The Mafia, Donna Poldina, is just an invention of the fascists in the north.
Poldi nodded and thought for a moment.
Let's assume, purely theoretically, that Valentino was murdered by a relatively unimportant criminal organization that traditionally kills traitors and competitors with a sawn-off shotgun. Why should it have done that? Valentino was such a nice young fellow.
Boh!
Busaka exclaimed, spreading his hands in a gesture of utter ignorance.
Perhaps he wasn't what he seemed. Perhaps he knew too much.
About Russo, you mean?
Busaka gave another shrug.
I mean nothing. Nor do I subscribe to rumours.
All at once, death had entered my Auntie Poldi's life once more. He had sneaked up on her from behind, shouted, Boo! And laughingly reminded her of his power and the expiry of her own deadline. All at once he was there again. The jack-in-the-box, the capricious gin whose embrace she had yearned for so ardently, wanting him at last to bring the curtain down on this lousy farce of a life. To request the audience to refrain from applauding and leave the theatre quickly, that had been her aim. To take the whole messy business into her own hands and, having got pleasantly sozzled to the accompaniment of Gloria and the sound of the sea, to let herself glide over to the other side, where my Uncle Pepe might still be waiting for her. But all at once death was there and laughing at her.
"This isn't fair!"
she shouted. Death merely brushed that aside.
"Come off it, Poldi. Did you really think you could trick me? Simply overtake me on the right? I thought we'd settled that."
"But why Valentino? What a waste of youth and joie de vivre."
Death just shrugged his shoulders and made a tick on his to-do list.
"It all went off according to plan."
But that, of course, was no way to treat my Auntie Poldi. Not even Death could get away with that.
"You can kiss my ass," she yelled. "If you don't keep your agreements, neither will I, okay?"
Death looked puzzled for a moment and re-examined his to-do list, then tapped his clipboard pedantically.
"In the first place, my dear Poldi, there's nothing here about any agreement. And secondly..."
That was as far as he got, because Poldi booted him hard in the backside. Then, in order to get the suspension of her contractual relationship with Death endorsed by higher authority, she did something she very seldom did. She prayed. Although she went to the church of Santa Maria del Rosario every Sunday, this wasn't because she was a believer. She went because she liked chain-smoking Padre Paolo, and because the Madonna beside the altar looked so heart-rendingly sad. The very epitome of sorrow. Moreover, my Auntie Poldi liked the smell of incense, and joined in the hymns enthusiastically, especially as she found the Italian words less annoyingly idiotic than the German. Besides, going to church on Sundays was simply a part of Torre's social life. Your granita somehow tasted better afterwards. And anyway, atheist or not, Poldi simply thought it behooved her to say a prayer for Valentino, who had always worn a crucifix on the chain around his neck. So that Sunday,
My Auntie Poldi sat in the front pew, dressed all in black, with a lace shawl over her wig, like a mafia widow in a B-feature, and asked the Almighty to accept Valentino's soul, and persuade Uncle Pepe to wait for her a little longer. The same afternoon, as expected, Poldi received a visit. She had just cut a photo of Valentino out of La Sicilia and pinned it to a corkboard on her bedroom wall when the doorbell rang. Montana was still wearing the same suit, but he and the suit were looking rather crumpled, as though they had both been through a lot in the last day and a half. Poldi, who was still attired in black, feigned surprise and invited the policeman in.
"Some coffee, commissario?"
A momentary pause, then,
"Please."
Montana surveyed his surroundings while Poldi was in the kitchen making coffee. He noted the half-full bottle of brandy, cast a fleeting glance into the bedroom, and inspected the ebony idols, decorative spears, and crudely carved masks in the living room.
"Have you been to Africa a lot?"
"No,"
lied Poldi, because she preferred to gloss over that chapter in the novel of her life. Montana turned his attention to the collection of antique firearms.
"Quite an arsenal you have here."
"From my father,"
Poldi called from the kitchen.
"It doesn't include a Lupara."
"Can they be fired?"
"What? Of course not. They've all been officially deactivated."
"Are you a good shot?"
"Fair to middling. But in any case, Valentino's murderer didn't need to be a marksman."
With a sigh, Montana sat down on the sofa. He noticed the copy of La Sicilia with the excision in it.
"Mind if I smoke?"
"Feel free, commissario."
Poldi heard the click of his cigarette lighter. She could sense that he was watching her through the kitchen door. Unobtrusively bracing herself, she presented his laser-beam gaze with her best physical assets and imagined it was his hands.
"Are you married, signora?"
"I used to be. My husband died many years ago."
"Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to."
"You didn't. How about you?"
"It's complicated."
Complications were another field of Poldi's expertise. She emerged from the kitchen with the coffees and some colourful little marzipan fruit she'd bought from Signora Cocuzza just in case.
"I like complications. How complicated are yours?"
Montana cleared his throat.
"When did you move here, signora?"
"Poldi. Call me Poldi. Just over a month ago."
"And you seem to know everyone in the locality. Wherever I go, you were there before me."
"I'm the communicative type."
"Your Italian is pretty good."
"Apart from my accent, you mean? Thanks. I get by."
"When did you learn it?"
"Oh, over the years. My husband was a Sicilian."
"From this area?"
Poldi sat down on the sofa beside Montana. She had to restrain herself from crowding him.
"In a manner of speaking. He was born in Munich and only spoke Bavarian and Sicilian. We often spent the summer here with his sisters, and I sometimes came to Italy on business."
Montana was smoking his cigarette like calm personified. Poldi half welcomed and half resented this, because she would have preferred him to be a trifle nervous in her presence. She was accustomed to a different reaction.
"You've created a fine old mess, signora, do you know that? You called the Carabinieri and the state police, and the result has been a squabble over spheres of responsibility."
"I thought you were heading the investigation."
"Yes, but I have to keep those idiots permanently in the loop. Still, that's not your problem."
Montana stubbed out his half-smoked cigarette and sank his teeth into a dark red marzipan cherry, as plump and authentic-looking as the real thing.
This pasta reale is really fresh."
"Glad you're enjoying it. There's no one I like better than an appreciative guest."
My Auntie Poldi was adept at subtle eroticism. She also liked to get straight to the point.
"Now then, commissario, have you found out anything new?"
Montana took his time. He ate the rest of the cherry and sugared his coffee.
"Why didn't you tell me you'd made inquiries about Valentino?"
"Oh, because I failed to discover anything.
Certainly no more than you have since yesterday."
"How would you know?"
"Take it as a compliment. I'm sure you've interviewed Valentino's parents and Russo, haven't you? Do you know where Valentino was killed? Were there any clues on his body?
Montana briefly swirled his coffee cup and downed its contents in one. He was wearing an open-necked shirt, and Poldi glimpsed a well-tanned chest. Her suit, but not too her suit, and sprinkled with a few white hairs, it seemed to whisper sweet nothings to her. She imagined herself unbuttoning his shirt and conducting some gentle preliminary research at first hand, then pulled herself together.
"What about the red sand in Valentino's trouser pocket? It came from Russo's nursery, didn't it?"
"So you did rummage in his pockets?"
"I only looked while I was holding his hand. Well?"
Montana shook his head and eyed her suspiciously.
"Russo's hiding something, don't you think?"
Poldi persisted.
"Does he have an alibi for the time in question?"
"I think you're hiding something from me, Signora Oberreiter."
"Poldi, just Poldi."
She was now sitting so close to Montana, she could have grasped that strong, shapely hand of his. She was on the point of owning up about the two pieces of mosaic, but she felt it would only have got her into more trouble. It wasn't that my Auntie Poldi ever ran away from trouble, but something else held her back. An instinctive restlessness that had dominated the Oberreiter family for generations, taking hold of the entire body and arising whenever the wind changed, whenever the world went awry and called for adjustment and correction. That was when my Auntie Poldi experienced a kind of tug in the guts, an unpleasant tightening of the skin like sunburn, a change in her general well-being, a kind of atavistic wanderlust that could be cured only by setting off at once into the unknown, and it grew worse the longer departure was postponed. It was the hunter's instinct. Perhaps Montana had noticed that fever in my aunt's eyes, that particular form of hunger he recognized from his own experience and that of some of his colleagues.
"So you've nothing more to tell me?" he persisted.
Poldi leant forwards, cursing the fact that she was still wearing her high-necked church-going dress.
"No,"
she said in a low voice. She could smell Montana's aftershave, a whiff of sandalwood, couscous and tobacco laced with a hint of sweat, a mixture that demanded almost inhuman self-control from her. Montana cleared his throat but couldn't move away. He picked up the newspaper and tapped the spot where Valentina's photograph had been.
"I'd like to make something clear, Signora."
"Poldi?"
"Keep out of this. I've got enough on my plate as it is."
Poldi was galvanized.
"You mean," she exclaimed, "I've stirred up a hornet's nest, and now you're being pressured into sweeping something under the carpet. Who is it, Russo?"
"You know," Montana said with a sigh, "I hate it when someone obstructs me in my work, so keep out of it. I mean that in the friendliest way, do you understand?"
Poldi looked at him and nodded.
"I understand."
"No playing Miss Marple, are we agreed?"
"We'd make such a good team, though."
"Are we agreed? If not, I'll have to come and see you again."
My Auntie Poldi construed this as an invitation, and as a definite indication that a terrible battle was raging within Montana's splendid, hairy chest between the inner demon of the steadfast, lonely sleuth and the inner demon of passion. And Poldi knew a thing or two about inner demons and passion.
"I agree,"
she said with a smile, resting her hand on his.
"But only if you at least answer me one question. Who was the last person to see Valentino alive?"
Montana withdrew his hand.
"To date, Signora, it's still you."
He looked at his watch, rose stiffly to his feet, and handed Poldi his card.
"In case something more occurs to you."
"Why in such a hurry, Commissario? It's Sunday. Some more coffee?"
"I've a murder to solve."
In the doorway, he turned and looked at Poldi. As before, his gaze seemed to pierce her through and through.
"Thanks for the coffee, and welcome to Sicily."
"And that was all?"
Aunt Louisa asked that evening.
You let him go just like that.
What was I supposed to do, handcuff him? Don't worry, though. Signor Adonis took the bait. I've got a feel for that sort of thing.
You really ought to keep out of it, said Aunt Teresa.
You'll only make trouble for yourself,
warned Aunt Caterina.
Fiddlesticks,
cried Aunt Louisa, who was more enterprising.
Forza Poldi.
My aunts are vernal creatures. Ever beautiful, ever in bloom, a trifle sensitive and reserved if there's a cold wind blowing, but brimming with laughter and confidence at the least sign of a thaw. Always ready to render assistance, to bestow consolation, to give pleasure, to feed cats, to love and enjoy, to bring up grandchildren, to protect sisters-in-law from themselves, or to cook their nephew a dish of spaghetti. Teresa, Caterina, and Luisa had grown up in Munich, but during the 1970s they met their husbands while on vacation in Sicily, and soon afterwards moved back home with my grandparents. Only my father and Uncle Pepe stayed behind in Germany, but they are both dead. The aunts are my only remaining relations on my father's side. They're all very small, those three vernal creatures, and all born under the sign of Taurus, so they're contented, patient women and sensual pragmatists who appreciate good food and nice perfumes, harmony and solid prosperity. They love life. What they hate, on the other hand, is change, turmoil and unreliability. If someone shoves them around too much, lets them down or gets on their nerves, they can really lose it. That's when the fun stops and it's time to take cover. Where men are concerned, though, they have a slight penchant for unreliable adventurers and twinkle-toed eccentrics. Take Uncle Martino, for instance, who wasn't taking part in the conversation, but getting ready to barbecue half the fauna of the Mediterranean, clad only in a pair of ancient shorts.
"What does a commissario like that earn? Does anyone know? What did he smell like? And he liked the marzipan, you say?"
"A creased suit means nothing. It's the shoes that matter. They're always worth a second look."
"His business card isn't very impressive. I used to know a Montana family from Lentini. Nice folk. Lawyers, some of them."
"Heavens, Poldi, don't be so secretive."
But Poldi was thinking of Valentino, and the morning when she found him on the beach. When she hunkered down beside his corpse, held his cold hand and made him a promise, that she would do all in her power to find his murderer. And she already had a suspicion.
"I mean,"
she muttered to herself, "who murders someone with a lupara these days?" But the aunts would have none of this.
"Whenever you Germans say Sicily, you really mean the Mafia,"
Aunt Caterina cried indignantly.
"You're positively obsessed with the Mafia. No, worse than that, you're in love with the Mafia. You romanticize it like everything else."
"As if there aren't criminal gangs elsewhere in the world," Aunt Louisa chimed in.
"The Mafia,"
Aunt Teresa stated categorically,
"is just an invention on the part of North Italian fascists designed to give us Southerners a bad reputation."
But that wouldn't wash with Poldi, of course.
"Come off it. Why do I read the M-word in every edition of La Sicilia?" "Anyway,"
Aunt Teresa said stoutly,
"even in Italy the police are still responsible for murder inquiries.
But I can at least keep an eye on the Signor Commissario and see he doesn't go astray."
"Talking of going astray," said Caterina, pointing reproachfully at a big wooden crate in the courtyard, which was overflowing with empty beer, wine and spirit bottles, "did you drink all those in the last week?"
Poldi sighed, because now she had to come clean. This was serious.
"I had a drink or two the day before yesterday, but most of them I poured down the drain," she said deliberately, but with a slight tremor in her voice.
"The thing is,"
she harrumphed, drew a deep breath, braced herself, and spoke the fateful words,
"I'm on the wagon."
Louisa, Caterina, and Teresa stared at her in disbelief.
"For the time being,"
she added quickly,
"it's just that I need a clear head and sweet breath at the moment."
Universal delight. The aunts beamed. Aunt Teresa sat up a little straighter.
How can we help?
Her sisters nodded enthusiastically. It should be explained that all three of them are ardent fans of police procedurals, and, thanks to satellite television, cast their net widely. Poldi looked surprised.
What about, even in Italy, the police are still responsible for murder inquiries?
Teresa dismissed this objection with a brusque gesture, and spread her fingers while speaking, as she always did when important matters were under discussion.
You may not have been able to save Valentino's life, she said firmly, but we can at least save yours.
Although Poldi hadn't asked to be saved, she was touched by this suggestion. Besides, she really could use some help, so she fetched the two little pieces of glazed ceramic from her bedroom and deposited them on the table.
Where might these have come from?
The aunts inspected the tesserae, but were no wiser.
Amore!
Aunt Teresa called through the window. Rather sweaty, with sooty hands and a cigarette in the corner of his mouth, Uncle Martino came shuffling in. Having donned one of the three pairs of reading glasses suspended from chains around his neck, he scrutinized the ceramic fragments with the air of a jeweler offered some trashy items from a flea market. He weighed them in his hand, held them up to the light, and eyed them closely from every angle. "They're fragments of old tiles," he mumbled eventually. "Pretty old, I'd say. They don't produce glazes like that these days. That luminosity, that blue. I guess they were parts of a floor, or a wall, or a mosaic."
"You can tell that, can you?"
Poldi exclaimed in surprise. Uncle Martino nodded. "Hmm.
Have you seen that sort of thing before?"
"Hmm.
Where?"
Uncle Martino shrugged his shoulders. "In old palaces and country mansions. Common folk couldn't afford such things. They'd cost a fortune even today."
"I thought you said no one produces them anymore."
"I meant the old originals, of course. People who can afford it get old tiled floors laid in their new houses. The tiles have to be carefully removed from some old palace, of course." Poldi didn't catch on right away.
"You mean there are people who sell their precious old tiled floors?"
"Sell them? Most of them are stolen while the houses are empty. Some professional gangs can strip a whole floor in a night." With this subject in mind, my Auntie Poldi visited her new friend Valerie at Femina Morta the next morning.
"I've been worried about you,"
Valerie cried in relief as Poldi got out of her car.
"Where have you been? I called you heaps of times." "I was in a bad way,"
Polly said apologetically.
"Mon Dieu, I can imagine. It's really awful. Is it true that you found Valentino on the beach?"
So word had leaked out.
"How did you know?" "From Turi, one of Rousseau's workers. His nephew Alfio is in the Carabinieri. He was first on the scene. After you, I mean." "Has a Commissario Montana called on you already?" "A good-looking oldish man? Yes, yesterday. Why?"
"Well, he's not as old as all that, but never mind.
Did he ask about me?" "Yes, indeed. He wanted to know exactly how we met, but I don't think he suspects you. He seemed more interested, if you know what I mean." "How about you?"
Valerie laughed.
"I don't think he suspects me. I mean, do you think I killed Valentino?" "Mon Dieu, no."
"You hardly know me." Valerie looked at Poldi.
"Believe me, Donna Poldina, I think you might be capable of a lot of things, but murder, never."
Poldi drew a deep breath. A gentle breeze laden with a faint scent of rosemary and hibiscus was rustling the bougainvillea that trailed halfway across the house. Turning her head a little, Poldi caught sight of one of Valerie's friendly mongrels dozing under an avocado tree in the garden. Turning a little further, she saw the sea glittering below. Valentino was dead, but here, at this moment, everything was filled with promise, imbued with life. The sheer, overwhelming superabundance of it was unbearable. But that was Sicily.
"Poldi? Mon Dieu,
Are you crying again?
Poldy shook her head.
No, I was only thinking it's time we called each other, too.
Valerie smiled.
How about some coffee?
It tasted as frightful as ever, like burnt rubber gaskets. Poldy would have liked to lace it with some brandy, but she was determined to remain stone-cold sober during her investigations, so she copied her new friend and sweetened it with 5 spoonfuls of sugar. Quite apart from the undeniable awfulness of Valerie's coffee, coffee drinking in Italy is nothing like the activity portrayed by television commercials. It has nothing to do with coffee as a beverage, only with sugar. Coffee is merely a hot, aromatic, caffeinated liquid designed to dissolve sugar, so you don't need much of it. It can be small, as long as it's strong, but sweetness is paramount. That's why many baristas mix coffee and sugar in the filter itself. There's nothing more bizarre to a Sicilian than drinking an espresso without sugar. Mind you, having a cappuccino after lunch and cycling along the Provinciale are probably considered more bizarre still. Valerie regarded my aunt attentively over her coffee cup. Poldy showed her the pieces of glazed ceramic.
"You aren't by any chance missing the floor these came from?"
Valerie shook her head, but she seemed to get the point.
"No. I'm missing a lion, though."
"Exactly when did it disappear?"
Valerie thought a while.
"I noticed it was gone on Wednesday. Why are you interested?"
"Do you still assume it was a warning from Rousseau?"
Valerie shrugged her shoulders.
"Looking at it from another angle," Poldy persisted, "what would a lion like that be worth on the open market?"
"Mon Dieu, I've no idea. A couple of thousand euros, maybe? Are you going to tell me what this is about?"
The shaggy mutt beneath the avocado tree stretched and got to its feet. It gave Poldy a pathetically mournful look, shook itself briefly, and trotted off as if that said it all. Poldy felt a familiar itch beneath her wig, and drew a deep breath.
"I may have an idea why Valentino had to die."
Chapter 5 Tells of Poldy's tenacity and of how she follows up her original suspicion. In this connection, she finds it useful to resort to behaviour she often engaged in at anti-imperialist demos in the distant past. She has an unpleasant encounter and takes a photograph in Taormina. Vito Montana wears a smart suit and is at pains to present a bella figura at all times.
"Why Rousseau?"
Valerie asked uneasily.
"It's obvious," said Poldy.
"One, Valentino probably belonged to a gang that looted old country houses. 2, Valentino worked for Rousseau. 3, Rousseau wants to put you under pressure, so he stole your lion."
"That's only a suspicion, though. I can't prove anything."
"But just assume it's true. Rousseau would need trusty henchmen like Valentino."
"But, mon Dieu, why should he have murdered him?"
The question of motive was a sore point with Poldy, who dodged it like a police press officer.
"Well," she said, "our inquiries are still at a very early stage."
"Our inquiries?"
"Commissario Montalas and mine. Does Rousseau have a son as well as a daughter?"
"No."
"Ah, I knew it."
"I don't understand, Poldy."
"Look, that night at your Uncle Mimi's, Rousseau said something significant, that Valentino had a lot of potential. He seemed positively hurt, as though the boy had disappointed him in some way. I suspect he was fond of him. He may even have regarded him as a son. What if Valentino let him down badly over something, and he blew a fuse?"
"I'm afraid you're getting carried away, Poldy."
"Just wait and see."
It was no use arguing. Resolutely, Poldy marched across Valerie's garden and invaded Rousseau's arboreal empire for a second time, intent on questioning his workforce. In an exalted, forensic frame of mind, she strolled, as if blown there by some capricious gust of wind, through the orderly ranks of palms, olive groves, lemon trees, bougainvilleas, oleanders, and strelitzias. She was so busy nodding affably in all directions, she narrowly missed being run over by a mechanical digger.
Nizica!
The driver swore at her in Sicilian.
L'occhi su fatti pitagliari!
Poldi found this neither comprehensible nor impressive.
Good morning. Lovely day, isn't it? What a nice machine you've got there. You must be the foreman. Tell me, did you know Valentino?
Without a word, the driver put his digger in gear and stepped on the gas again. Poldi was enveloped in a cloud of dust as it roared past her.
Hey, wait!
She cried in vain. Next attempt, two young workmen repotting palm shoots.
Good morning. My, you're good at that. How quick you are. Very impressive. Have you worked here long?
They merely stared at her in silence. Undeterred, she pressed on.
Did you know Valentino?
The guy with the Trinacria tattooed on his arm?
Yes, that's him. Valentino Candela. Terrible, isn't it? What was his relationship like with your boss?
A brief exchange of glances, then they turned away as if in response to a command and simply plodded off, leaving Poldi standing there.
Hello? Signori? Please don't walk off.
Next attempt, an elderly workman pruning some young olive trees. Poldi noticed that one of his little fingers was missing.
Good morning. Please excuse me, but I think I've lost my way.
Where did you want to go?
To see Signor Russo.
The boss is bound to be over there in the main building, but you'll need an appointment, Signora.
Thanks. Very nice of you. Hey, isn't it awful about Valentino? They say he was like a son to Signor Russo.
That was as far as she got.
Signora?
Poldi turned to see the two security guards familiar to her from her previous visit. They were still wearing identical shades, the narrow wraparound sort that resemble reptilian eyes.
Kindly come with us.
Where to, if I may ask?
Off the premises.
Is it forbidden to have a little chat with someone? This is plain ridiculous.
You're trespassing on private property, Signora. Please don't make any trouble.
Well, who's making trouble? Only you two comedians, that's who.
The men looked like twins. They seemed rather uneasy, but a job was a job. One of them stepped forward and touched Poldi on the arm in an attempt to get her to move at last and come with them.
Please, Signora.
But no one did that to my Auntie Poldi. In the grip of old reflexes, she fiercely wrenched her arm away.
Let go of me!
She yelled at the two shades.
How dare you! This is deprivation of liberty! Help! Help!
She was giving vent to her wide experience of demos. Too young for the Munich riot of 1962, there was scarcely a demo in which Poldi had not taken part after 1968, when she turned sweet 16. She marched everywhere, against state tyranny and the Shah, emergency legislation and the arms race, chanted in favour of women's rights, sexual liberation and equality of education, and slept with revolutionaries, rock stars, honest biology students, budding terrorists and future government ministers. Until the mid-1980s, she had regularly participated in peace marches and sit-ins against NATO's double-track decision, Pershings and dumping sites for nuclear waste, chained herself to railings and thrown flower bags at politicians, so it might be said that my Auntie Poldi had some experience of dealing with the forces of law and order. Yelling alternately in Italian and Bavarian, she went berserk like a dervish on cart, or Rumpelstiltskin on a Café Doppio Ristretto. The scene she made did not fail to have an effect on the two security guards, who stood rooted to the spot, staring in astonishment at my fiercely gesticulating, loudly vociferating aunt, and only half-heartedly fending off her furious blows. Russo's workers, who had rapidly gathered around the scene of the action, anxious not to miss anything, were highly entertained by all this. No one laid hands on Poldi, and no one made any further attempt to hustle her off the premises. She had won. However, it wasn't long before she ran out of breath and had to abandon her antics. It should be borne in mind that Poldi was no longer 16, but 60. So she automatically ceased to be a virago and became an elderly woman, perspiring and rather breathless. She was fully aware of this, of course, but before she allowed the security guards to lead her away, she turned and sketched a curtsy to the workmen around her. My Auntie Poldi knew how to quit the stage, namely, to a round of applause.
"Mon Dieu, what happened over there?"
Valérie exclaimed when Poldi returned to Femina Morta, exhausted but not dissatisfied.
"I heard you shouting, and then applause."
Poldi straightened her wig and looked Valérie in the eye.
"That, my dear, was only the start. I shall repeat the procedure every day until someone bloody well talks to me." "Did Rousseau appear?"
"Afraid not, but give me time. Hey, do you think I could have a glass of water? Or maybe a little prosecchino for my nerves?" "I thought you were supposed to be on the wagon," I said when Poldi told me about this later.
"Oh, come on. One little prosecco isn't a drink."
No?
"No. Look at it this way. Mick Jagger and Keith Richards used to drink and smoke grass till it came out of their ears. But now they're all clean and teetotal, eat their muesli like good boys and don't touch alcohol anymore. Only champagne."
As threatened, my Auntie Poldi went back the next day and repeated the procedure. She began by strolling around Rousseau's property for a while, then chatted to a few of his workers. Then the security men turned up. Having performed her little routine once more, Poldi meekly allowed them to remove her from the premises. It was a reprise of the previous day, but with one minor difference. Rousseau's workers spotted my Auntie Poldi from afar and waved to her, gleefully awaited her performance, and sent her on her way with loud applause. Poldi graciously acknowledged this, waving and blowing kisses in all directions. But Rousseau didn't appear. The following day, Wednesday, she had to suspend her investigations in order to attend her usual Italian lesson with Michele in Taormina. She couldn't possibly play truant for two reasons. A. Michele himself, and B. the Vicele she'd recently photographed. Although Michele was definitely too young for Poldi's taste, being in his mid-thirties, she had no intention of missing a chance to feast her eyes on him. Far be it from me to be envious of Michele. He's a good friend of mine. He's amusing and a first-class teacher and businessman. He likes classical literature and gypsy swing, has seen something of the world, and is on the introverted side. But appearance-wise, even an average sort of guy who has turned out more or less okay is a dead loss compared to Michele, and that's a bit hard to cope with, because Michele looks like a top male model, like a heroic figure dreamt up by one of Mussolini's sculptors. I'll say no more. Michele didn't choose his personal appearance, nor did he parlay it into a profession. He founded a language school. No disrespect to Michele, but his courses were attended almost exclusively by, discounting Poldi, anorexic Scandinavian girls whose languishing eyes construed his every gesture as erotic. Or so I imagine. Anyway, Poldi never missed her Wednesday Italian lesson. She took advantage of the lunch break to go for a little walk through the old quarter of Taormina in search of the Vicele she'd recently photographed, hoping to make his acquaintance. She failed to see the traffic cop, but sighted Italo Russo and Corrado Patenay instead. They were seated at a small table outside the Wunderbar Café on the Corso Umberto, deep in conversation and leafing through some illustrations in a transparent folder. It didn't take Poldi long to decide what to do. Her Oberreiterish instinct simply took over. She threaded her way nimbly to the café through a bevy of tourists, sneaked around behind the two men's table, and sat down a little to one side, where she had a good view of the table, and Rousseau wouldn't see her unless he turned his head at least 90 degrees. She wasn't afraid Patenay would spot her, because his attention was so exclusively focused on Rousseau. From where she was sitting, Poldi couldn't make out the pictures in the transparent folder, but she tried to take a few unobtrusive snaps of them, in the hope that subsequent processing in a computer would reveal more, the way it always does on TV. In order to do this, however, she had to stand up again. This, in turn,
seemed to indicate to a German couple in practical, functional clothing that her table was free. They at once made a beeline for it, pushing past Rousseau and Patanet, and leaving a turmoil of apologies and jogged chairs in their wake. The man's rucksack caught in Patanet's chair and almost tipped it over. Poldi had only just sat down again and stowed the camera in her handbag when she saw Patanet jump to his feet, spilling his coffee over the transparent folder. Patanet swore, and the German vacationer mumbled an apology. That would have been that, had not Patanet caught sight of my aunt and promptly recognized her. He stared at Poldi for an instant, then nudged Rousseau and pointed in her direction. She could detect no emotion on Rousseau's face other than momentary surprise. He simply looked at her and came over to her table.
"Our paths seem to have crossed a lot in recent days, Signora."
"Often, but far too seldom, alas," Poldi trilled.
"And you've been making such efforts to impress me, haven't you?"
"Well, have I? Impressed you, I mean." Rousseau's tone changed abruptly.
"What exactly are you after, Signora?"
"Just a few answers on the subject of Valentino."
"I'm afraid I must disappoint you, Signora. I must also ask you to discontinue your performances on my property. Otherwise..."
"Otherwise?"
Rousseau drew a deep breath. "It's hot in August, Signora, and the ice is thin."
"Eh?" I exclaimed when my aunt described the confrontation later. Those were his actual words.
"So what did they mean?"
"You mean you don't get it? It was a straightforward death threat."
"Was straightforward as a corkscrew, more like."
"You simply don't have a feel for criminality, my boy. Me, I naturally interpreted it as an unvarnished death threat. And as things turned out not long afterwards, I was barking up the right tree."
Poldi's father, Detective Chief Inspector Georg Oberreiter, had taught her that the success of any police inquiry depends on two things: notebooks and corkboards. She had also learned from her father that nothing is more dangerous to an investigation than preliminary theories to which one clings for too long, although the facts have long been pointing in another direction, a classic pitfall besetting inexperienced doctors, motor mechanics, paleontologists, and detective inspectors alike. Poldi kept the danger of the preliminary hypothesis at the back of her mind, but until something better presented itself, she steadfastly and doggedly continued to pursue her original suspicion. First, however, she bought herself a notebook in which she recorded every lead, every clue, every name, every phone number, every fart, absolutely every last thing. The most important leads she neatly transferred to a card index and pinned up on the wall of her bedroom, together with photographs, newspaper articles, and a map of Sicily. Any items she believed to be connected in some way were linked with lengths of coloured wool. Thus her bedroom wall gradually sprouted a peculiar species of lichen, an autonomous creature that whispered unintelligible things to Poldi when she went to bed and when she woke up. One day, of this she was firmly convinced, that creature on her bedroom wall would tell her point-blank who had murdered Valentino. Until then, she must simply feed it well, ask questions and keep her ears open, make a nuisance of herself and kick up a fuss. My Auntie Poldi was particularly good at this last activity. Uncle Martino combed the internet and the local newspaper archives for reports of art thefts and thefts from construction sites, and brought Poldi masses of material, which she conscientiously pinned to her corkboard. When she looked at it at night, she seemed to be staring into an abyss that threatened to engulf half of Sicily. So much was being stolen from the island's palatial country houses. Even though she eschewed the M-word as far as possible, she felt there was only one conclusion, that a well-lubricated criminal machine must be behind it all, headed by Rousseau. Her problem was how to make the contents of the transparent folder fit this hypothesis, because the photograph she'd taken simply failed to enlighten her. My cousin Samuele, the computer salesman's son of Aunt Luisa, had casually waved the magic wand of commercial image enhancement software over the photo. He enlarged it,
adjusted the focus and contrast, lightened the shadows a little, and bingo! One could more or less make out what Rousseau and Patanet had been studying with such interest. But only more or less, because the image remained badly pixelated, like a photograph of a galaxy on the outskirts of the universe, and required no little imagination. With the best will in the world, it was impossible to make out any lion, mosaics, country houses, or ancient art treasures on the photo, however hard Poldi gazed at it from every angle.
Rather, it seemed that the exposed sheet inside the folder was a document of some kind, with an illustration beneath it.
The text of the document was illegible, pixelated mush, and Poldi surmised that the three-colored illustration was a structural drawing or diagram, or something quite else.
"Hell's bells,"
she said in a disappointed growl as she pinned up the photo. Then, because she didn't want to seem ungrateful to the mechanics of chance, she added, "Namaste, camera." Because everything in the world, my Auntie Poldi felt convinced, possessed a soul. To her there were no inanimate objects, only mute ones, so it was better to treat them with respect. If you did, they could sometimes prove remarkably generous. Vague threats had never deterred my Auntie Poldi from anything, so she showed up at Rousseau's tree nursery the very next day and spoke to his workers again. When was the last time they'd seen Valentino? What was his relationship to the boss? And had they noticed anything unusual about the recent behavior of either man? She had no more success than she'd had on the two previous occasions. One of her interlocutors was Turi, the old man with the missing finger.
"Look, signora,"
he said unhappily, purging his Italian of as much Sicilian dialect as possible,
"we aren't allowed to talk to you. The boss has expressly forbidden us to. We don't know anything anyway. Poor Valentino was a good lad, and that's the way we all want to remember him. So please, signora, leave us to do our work in peace and go home. It really would be the best thing for everyone."
Poldi was about to persist, needless to say, but before she could tackle poor Turi again, she saw him stiffen with panic. Remarkably agile, despite her bulk, she spun round and saw two dappled brown shadows streaking towards her. Not Oscar and Lady, the friendly mongrels, but two nightmares on four legs. Even before she could utter a cry, they sprang at her and knocked her over on her back amid the pruned olive trees. She caught a glimpse of her wig as it came adrift and flew up into the summer sky. Then all she could see was a pair of vicious canines barking furiously in her face. In shock, she simply stared at the German shepherds for 1, 2, 3 seconds. Then she emitted a full-throated yell that conveyed all the rage and fear within her.
"Get off me, you filthy brutes!"
This left the dogs quite cold. They continued to bark just as loudly and didn't retreat an inch, snapping at my aunt if she stirred, but not biting her. "Hans! Franz! Enough! Hier!" A crisp command in German, with a strong Italian accent. It's an odd thing, the Italian predilection for ordering dogs around in German. I have no idea how it originated. The dogs pricked up their ears and got off Poldi. This enabled my aunt to sit up and obey her immediate impulse. She groped for her wig in the dust and hurriedly replaced it, just before Rousseau's shadow fell across her.
"We meet again, signora."
He sounded as dispassionate as a supermarket cashier, almost bored. Poldi tried to scramble to her feet, but was defeated by her bad knee. Kneeling in front of Rousseau in a supremely humiliating way, she made another vain attempt to rise. At a sign from Rousseau, two members of his staff eventually set her back on her feet. Hans and Franz continued to growl at her viciously.
"I must have failed to express myself clearly enough yesterday,"
Rousseau began, once Poldi was standing in front of him, panting.
"Would you put on a show like this if the police were here?"
she growled.
"Glad you reminded me. I must call the Carabinieri at once and report a case of trespass. It wouldn't surprise me if something has been damaged or stolen."
"If you think I'm going to piss my pants, you arrogant bastard, think again,"
she yelled at him in Bavarian.
"Have a nice day, signora."
Russo turned on his heel and clicked his tongue, whereupon the German shepherds she had often trotted back to the administration building. Poldi adjusted her wig, striving to convey dignity and composure. She was aware that she had made an enemy. "Fuck him," she said to herself. Montana turned up that same afternoon.
"Would you care to tell me what you've been up to?"
He was looking positively furious. Poldi thought it suited him better than his hangdog expression. Far more in keeping with his dark blue suit and dark blue shirt, aviator sunglasses and well-polished brogues. He didn't look creased and crumpled anymore, but filled with indignation and Italianità. He seemed impervious even to the heat. "He's smartened himself up," was Poldi's first thought when she answered the door. Her second thought was adults only.
"I told you to keep out of it," he thundered. "Even here in Sicily, the police are responsible for murder inquiries. No one else."
Poldi treated him to a long, meaningful look. "Are you through?"
Montana drew a deep breath. "No, far from it."
"Then you'd better come in. You're standing right in the sun. Coffee?"
"I mean it, Donna Poldi,"
Montana insisted as he followed her into the house.
"You're merely making trouble for me and hampering my inquiries."
"How?"
"Don't you understand? When Russo makes a complaint, he naturally goes to the very top. Colonnello La Rossa of the Carabinieri is a good friend of his."
"But you're state police."
"That's just it. The Colonnello naturally calls my chief at once and gives him hell. What's all this about some German woman conducting unofficial inquiries into the Candela case, not to mention harassing honest citizens and breaking the law? My boss and the Colonnello detest each other and seize any opportunity to get a dig in. The chief was naturally incensed by this. He calls me, reads me the riot act, and threatens to take me off the case unless I get things under control."
Poldi handed Montana a cup of coffee and proffered the whiskey bottle. "Like a dash?"
"Aye," growled Montana.
Pleased by this imperative in the familiar second-person singular, it meant go ahead, Poldi topped up his cup and treated herself to a dash as well. This time, Montana downed his espresso immediately. "I get it," said Poldi. "You're scared of being taken off the case, or even of being fired." He gave a little bark of laughter.
"Nonsense. I'm not scared. No one's going to take me off the case or fire me. I'd like to see them try. No one else wants a confounded case, but I don't want to look like the kind of fool who can be led by the nose, not in front of my colleagues."
Montana held out his coffee cup, and Poldi promptly poured him another slug. "Ah, now I get it," she said. "You don't want to look bad."
This cupful, too, went straight down the hatch. "Precisely," he said.
For this is the worst thing that can happen to any Italian male, especially a Sicilian. Economic crises, volcanic eruptions, corrupt politicians, emigration, the mafia, uncollected rubbish, and overfishing of the Mediterranean. He can endure anything with fatalism and a bella figura. The main thing is never to present a brutta figura, a figuraccia. Bella figura is the Italian credo. The basic equipment for this includes a well-groomed, unostentatiously fashionable appearance, a pair of good shoes, and the right make of sunglasses. Above all, though, bella figura means always looking good, never foolish. For an Italian, this is a must, not an option, and quite indispensable. It also means you don't embarrass your fellow men. Impatience is unacceptable, and direct confrontations are taboo. You share restaurant bills with your friends. Don't put your foot in it. Never receive guests in a dirty or untidy home. Ask no intimate questions. Address anyone with a university degree as dottore. Bring some dessert with you when invited to dinner. And, even at the risk of rupturing your abdomen, finish everything on your plate.
You put your faith in beauty and proportionality and try to make the world a better place. Sometimes you even succeed. My Auntie Poldi and the Commissario were standing close together, coffee cups in hand like little security barriers. Poldi didn't speak, just looked at Montana expectantly, and he got the message, which was that he first had to deliver.
We found various clues on Valentino's body, that's all I can tell you.